Hey, listeners, we're nearing the end of our 15th anniversary fundraising campaign, and we need your help to meet our goal. This campaign offers you a chance to win a unique food and music experience in one of the most exciting cities in America. Here's how it works. Donate to HRN and you'll be entered to win dinner for two and two tickets to a concert in one of eight amazing cities: New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Nashville, Las Vegas, Charleston, Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and Asheville. All donations support our work educating food system storytellers. And when you donate, you can choose one of those cities and you'll be entered to win dinner and two tickets to a show. So help us reach our goal and enter to win dinner and a show in the city of your choice. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15. Thank you.
This episode is presented by New York Mutual Trading.
This week, Team HRN is at Charleston Wine and Food for the fifth year in a row. So, on this week's Meet and Three, we bring you some of our favorite sound bites from last year.
The hospitality here and the camaraderie is really wonderful. Yes. That's what struck
Everybody
me.
Everybody smiles.
So, imagine if you mix dirt with sand.
Yes.
You've got our earth.
Yes.
That sounds like that would be really poor.
Really poor, right?
You know, we can talk all we want about a good story, but a good story is useless if the wine isn't great.
It's highly Instagrammable. It looks so gory.
Tune in to Meet and Three, HRN's food news and storytelling roundup, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, and this is Eat Your Words. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and it is the first day of spring today, this March. We all got up an hour earlier than we thought, although I was really unprepared for that one. So I got to thank my guest today for making it, despite losing an extra hour. And he is also, we just discovered that he first came on this show exactly 10 years ago. So a veteran cookbook author, one of my favorite cookbook authors and food writers who has written for many publications, and he's also the editor and co-founder of Jari Magazine, or Quarterly. Do you call it Quarterly?
It's a bootstrapped independent magazine that we pull together our resources and put the issues when we can.
So that is none other than Lucas Wolger. Thanks so much for coming back.
Oh, thank you, Kathy.
Yeah, cheers. So this is actually my favorite book of yours so far.
Oh, thank you.
This book that I'm holding right now is called Start Simple, and it's your fourth book. So the first one was called Veggie Burgers Every Which Way.
Right.
And then it was followed up by Vegetarian Entrees. Did I do that?
That won't leave you hungry.
Right. And then there was Bowl a few years ago. And this one is not, you know, contained to a single sort of subject, or like the, you know, veggie burgers. Actually, Vegetarian Entrees was not either. But it is such a unique organization of a cookbook because it's based on these 11 essential ingredients that you can stock your pantry with and then play with, basically, to create meals. And I love it. So I actually wanted to read, I want to see if you could like just read a little bit from the introduction so you can introduce those ingredients. Okay.
Sure.
Awesome. You can start wherever you'd like.
Maybe, let's see. So I sort of start the book explaining the way I cook, the way most people I know who are skilled cooks who have been cooking for a long time, that they can sort of open up the fridge and they see possibility, you know, like with whatever random ingredients are there. And this is something that I've always been struggling with, how to like teach people who don't know how to cook. Like, and I wrote this book with my brother and his family in mind, and they have kind of this crazy life and are always wanting to like eat better and cook more, but always struggle with it. So just in trying to formulate a way of like helping them when they open their fridge and see like this fridge full of like things that they bought at Costco, and it's like so full of stuff. Like I open that and I'm like, okay, we've got dinner for a week, and they open it and they like don't know what to do.
Right.
And so anyway, that's sort of like where I'm setting the scene in terms of like me when I open my fridge and here's what I can do. And so the secret to this kind of cooking, which is a form of like improvisational cooking, is making sure that there will be ingredients on hand that spark inspiration, and then having a few ideas for what to do with them once they're at home. And that's what this book is about. It's manageable and inspiring everyday cooking with the types of recipes and tools that will help make everyday cooking a habit. So cookbooks that aim to unlock the secrets of weeknight cooking, they often overwhelm me. Mm-hmm. The shopping lists and the menus and the loads of prepping that needs to be done when you might otherwise be enjoying yourself over the weekend, it can be tough to see the forest through the trees. And with that type of plan, I often wonder if the sacrifice is actually outweighed by the reward. Instead, how about this? Getting into the habit of picking up most of these 11 primary ingredients that form the organizational system of the book.
All right. Well, so what are these 11 ingredients?
Okay, so they're all in these adorable illustrations on the cover.
Yes, they are.
We've got hearty greens.
Okay.
Beans, canned and dried. Summer squash, like zucchini and yellow squash. Eggs, cauliflower, broccoli. That's sort of one
chapter. That's one chunk. Okay.
Then winter squash, cabbage, mushrooms, tofu, tortillas, sweet potatoes, and then there's a bonus dessert chapter.
Ooh, awesome. All right. This is great. And it happens to be vegetarian. I know that you write that, you know, this is just kind of the way that it makes sense to you to eat. Actually, you wrote so eloquently that I don't even want to screw it up. What is your take on vegetarianism and your history with it?
So I've been strict vegetarian for stretches of my life, and then for the last several years I've been sort of like not a strict vegetarian. My default cooking is cooking, you know, what this book is very much like represents how I cook for myself on weeknights.
And it's all vegetarian.
All vegetarian. That's just like that's become my habit at home, how I stock my fridge. Mm-hmm. And then when I'm at somebody else's house or when I'm out to eat, I just don't worry about it that much.
Yeah. So it's very, I guess, flexitarian is another term that people say, or just plant-based or veggie-forward or some other buzzwords behind these things.
Well, and I feel like it's important to, like, divide the, like, stop focusing so much on, like, the identity of it and mm-hmm. instead, like, normalize plant-based and vegetarian and vegan eating so that it's, like, rather than being like, I'm having a vegan dinner tonight, it's like, I'm having dinner and it is vegan, but we don't even need to call it out because it's just, like, a normal dinner.
Right. You grew up in Boise, Idaho, though, and this wasn't exactly how you were raised.
No, not at all. I was the animal protein in the center of the plate and then a few like sides around the plate.
And you write that there's always a glass of milk
at
dinner. Yeah. Cow's milk, that is.
Cow milk. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, how times have changed.
I know, right?
But that's a pretty generic meal throughout many parts of America still. Mm-hmm. So, I love that you write so... Right, so your recipes are so effortless and, you know, they're not really ostentatiously flashy, yet they're beautiful, and they're not pounding you over the head with healthfulness, yet they're healthy, and they're also economical, because we're talking beans and, like, zucchini here, like, mm-hmm. this is all those 11 ingredients.
Your splurges are going to be, like, nice eggs or some
eggs,
cheese or something.
Right, and, absolutely. And or desserts, as you mentioned, or fruit, maybe. But, you know, I just want to give this book to everyone who says something like, you know, eating plant-based is somehow too expensive, too elitist, and just too difficult, because you make it very humble and hearty.
I've always loved this phrase, sensible food and sensible cooking, and in earlier iterations of this book while I was trying to, like, come up with a proposal. I love this like phrase, sensible food, but I like learned in talking with like book publishing people that it's a little bit of a downer. It doesn't get people excited. The word sensible. But it's like I've always been drawn to vegetarian and vegan food because it is so affordable, and it's a way to like kind of have standards about how, you know, you can follow, have a rubric of I want this to be organic, or I want it to come from the farmer's market, or and it's sort of like inherently healthier than like a lot of like prepared foods and stuff. And I mean, I'm not going to make the case that it's necessarily healthier than like a more omnivorous diet, but it's a way to eat really well and on a budget. So that's always, that's how I got into it originally.
And the stuff that you write about talks about incorporating things like leftover roasted squash, leftover roasted whatever, roasted mushrooms, fold it together with some scrambled eggs and let it puff up like a souffle in the oven. Some caramelized onions, which cost, you know, onions cost very little.
Yeah,
so, yeah, I mean, kudos to you for that.
Thank you.
One thing I noticed that you've been writing about beans for such a long time. In fact, your first book, I learned a lot about how to handle dry beans.
Oh, really?
Like, you went into such detail that I was like, oh, shoot, I didn't know, you know, like, I need to pick... I don't know. I just learned a lot of basics about cooking
and yet,
with beans.
Yet beans are still like this area of confusion for
right.
so many people.
Yeah.
They always will be, I think.
Dry beans
yeah.
and just beans in general.
Just
yeah.
beans in general, yeah.
I know. But they're very, I guess, on trend nowadays. There's
yeah, for sure.
Right? There's a whole book about it by Joe Yonan,
which
the editor
so
of the Washington Post, beans.
Yeah.
I've been seeing it on covers, too. I mean, there's a flash of beans on one of these toasts on the cover of your
mm-hmm.
book. I see that, you know, I just see that more and more. So what do you think, as somebody who's been writing about beans, you know, since your first book and so on, why do you think it's got suddenly captured a little bit of a trend right now? Or buzz?
I'm not entirely sure. I've read, like, a lot of the trend pieces. I think that people are, I think there's been a lot of... advances around like plant-based eating and vegetable forward cooking and
mm-hmm.
stuff. And so I think people have gotten a lot more accustomed to that. And beans are obviously this incredible source of like plant-based protein. And maybe people are waking up to that a little bit more. I also think like Rancho Gordo, he's been doing this for quite a long time. And, I've been a big fan of him for the last, Steve Sando. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
The past like 5-6 years, but he's just like, first off, it's this like incredibly thoughtful business, and everything is done with like such intention around like building, helping like restore
heirloom
beans
yeah.
and like work directly with farmers throughout like Central America. And
wow.
And then the packaging is so beautiful and it's like really fun. There's this like, it's kind of.
Beans are beautiful.
The beans are beautiful. And then there's this like sort of like campy woman with lips on the all the stickers around the beans. And so it's just like a covetable object. I think that has helped.
It's interesting. Yeah.
And I think, I don't know, chefs have been like making these delicious bean dishes on their menus.
Yeah.
And like, I think that's one of the things that's helping people to see them as being really delicious too. So it's not just this virtuous thing to be eating.
Right, right. I love it. One thing I wanted to ask about was, among these 11 ingredients, there was not an ingredient that I see often when it comes to like list of like what to stock your pantry with that you know, I've seen in cookbooks and also trend pieces about this subject. And that is canned tomatoes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of canned things, actually. Everything you have is fresh, except you said canned or dried beans.
Right.
So... what do you think about canned food and canned tomatoes? Is that like...
That's interesting that you noticed that. It certainly wasn't intentional.
Okay.
I think I always have canned tomatoes around, and mm-hmm. I find them to be really useful. I think for vegetarian cookbooks, like pasta is... that was where my head went first with canned tomatoes, even
mm-hmm.
though I know that they're used in all kinds of things. But I think I there are some pasta recipes in there, but I didn't want it to be too pasta forward.
Yeah,
I feel
yeah.
that's... maybe, and people don't think of pasta now as like a super, it's a comforting thing, but they don't think of it necessarily as a
right.
nourishing thing. So I wanted it not to be too pasta heavy.
Yeah.
But
like,
that certainly wasn't intentional.
Okay. Well, I think it's super refreshing because I think that otherwise it's like, but yeah, you mentioned all the pastas, all the canned tomatoes, canned whatever. It's kind of like, I've seen it before.
Yeah.
Know?
Okay,
so,
good.
And,
well, I definitely, in the pantry section, it was like, I've written these in my other books where you have to go through, it's like salt and a 10-inch skillet and like
right.
all these things. Like every freaking cookbook has this like passage of like how to stock your pantry and stock your kitchen. And does anybody need to read this? Does anybody know this? And
mm-hmm,
so I wanted
mm-hmm.
to like not include that. So I might have included canned tomatoes if I'd expanded that in a more traditional way.
Well, one thing I love that you included was also cabbage. And you write that it's, you know, kind of poor, lowly, overlooked ingredient. Maybe because we see it on the last, you know, the last sort of stragglers in the farmer's market at the end of winter.
And if anybody who's had a CSA, you have this, like, 14-pound cabbage that sits in your fridge for, like, 3 months.
You mean a cabbage baby?
Yeah.
I have one of those. Totally. Yeah, but you make them much more exciting in your recipes than the sad sort of coleslaw that you reference as like one of the few things that we tend to see cabbage in. Yeah,
though we did have a section of like fun slaws.
I like slaws. Me too. I do like slaws. I do like the normal slaw too.
But I've just been like out doing events for this book, and there are a lot of like passionate cabbage lovers out there. I didn't, you know, like. I think that maybe they've not been listened to or haven't been speaking up that much, but people really do love cabbage.
Oh, that's amazing.
And I think that cabbage is also having a little bit of a moment. I saw it was in Adina Sussman's book, the Sababa.
Sababa, yeah.
She has this roasted cabbage recipe that's getting tons of love. Ooh. And then Andy Barghini of Bon Appetit, he just did this recipe that has been also going viral with roasted cabbage. So I don't know, keep an eye on cabbage. They may be the next beans.
Do you call the cabbage heads? Can you call cabbage fanatics cabbage heads?
Oh, maybe, yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
Cabbage.
That was a bad one.
Anyway, we can edit that out.
Oh, man. So many recipes and fun stuff to talk about. And I also want to introduce a game called Mind Kitchen, where I'm going to throw a bunch of ingredients at Lucas verbally only, and he's going to tell me a beautiful meal, but I'm not going to use any of the ingredients that are on his list of 11 pantry staples.
Okay.
We're going to come to that right after a quick little commercial break, so hang tight.
This episode is brought to you by New York Mutual Trading, the premier Japanese food, alcoholic beverage, and restaurant supply specialist. Mutual Trading is the Japanese food authority, true to the heart in upholding genuine Japanese food traditions, and progressive in exploring new ways to provide innovative restaurant supplies and services. They import, export, distribute, and manufacture the top brands for retailer and food service customers nationwide. Learn more at nymtc.com.
All right, we're back chatting with Lucas Volger on your fourth time here at Heritage. Or
maybe even more than that. You've been so generous with my projects and whatnot.
I love your projects. No, thank you so much for coming. You've been generous with your time. And you've been a very good spirit here to take on this game that I'm going to present you with. So Mind Kitchen is actually a game that was invented by Matt Timms on Heritage Radio Network several years ago, and he did it for a few episodes, but it didn't last too long. So basically, it's like I'm going to tell you a bunch of ingredients, and you have to pretend that you're in a kitchen, and you have to make... You have to tell me what your entree is with them.
And using all the ingredients.
Basically, yeah.
I think they used to do this with Lynn on Splendid Table.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. It's basically like, you know, that show Chopped with the basket.
Okay. And just as a caveat, I've always been terrified of things like Chopped, like competitive, live thinking, no time to stew with stuff.
Well, I can't taste it, but we can judge. We can still judge you. So, okay, and none of them are going to be your favorite ingredients from this book.
Okay,
so we've got cherries, sweet cherries, fresh from like, you know, say you went to an orchard or the farmer's market.
Okay.
Tomatoes, also fresh.
Mm-hmm.
Frozen peas.
Oh, my God.
That's
this is like trans-seasonal.
That's actually one of my like must-haves of my kitchen, frozen peas.
Frozen peas. Okay,
I just
gotcha.
Like it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Potatoes, just normal potatoes. Scallions.
Can it be a smoothie?
Not now. You want scallions? And yogurt.
Okay.
And tahini.
Oh, okay. So I think I would do two dishes. I'm actually allergic to cherries, so I don't eat them that often.
Oh, shoot.
But I love, like, when I'm willing to, like, risk my throat closing up, I, like, love stone fruit with tomatoes. So I think I would do, like, a salad with the, like, thick slices of the tomatoes and then macerate the cherries in a little bit of, I guess, a teeny bit of salt and sugar and vinegar, and then...
By macerate, you mean just soak it?
Yeah, just to, like, break it down, soften it a little bit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then some olive oil, and if there were any herbs sitting around, do that kind of salad.
Fresh cherry and tomatoes. I love it.
Okay. I feel like that's a boring one. But then the other dish would be... So maybe strain the yogurt a little bit if it's a loose one to thicken it. Lobna style, and then do a schmear
on the bottom.
And then I'm just thinking like the peas and the tahini on top of the yogurt, so it's like have the peas, maybe cook them with a little bit
of potatoes.
Oh god, I forgot about the
peas, potatoes, scallions, yogurt, tahini. I think you're good.
I think you could, so maybe like steam the potato. God.
Ooh.
Well, I love cold potatoes. I put this like cold sweet potato dish in my...
Vichyssoise.
Well, I wasn't even thinking vichyssoise. I was thinking like I like cold cubes of potatoes.
Oh.
But so maybe this is going to sound vile, but steam the potatoes and then chill them and then cut them into little cubes.
Nice.
And then make a little salad with the scallions, the peas, the potatoes, and some like salt, pepper, olive oil, lemon. And then put that on top of the yogurt and drizzle it with tahini.
That I did not think of.
Really? I feel like that's the most obvious dish out there.
I would have thought to roast crispy little, like, almost like cubes of the potatoes. Oh, okay. And then, maybe like schmear or drizzle the yogurt and tahini. But you schmeared it.
I schmeared it. I love a schmear.
It sounds amazing, though. I can see it in my head because I love the idea of like having little baubles of the peas and little cubes of potatoes.
Yeah.
That sounds delightful.
Maybe we'll have to try that.
Yeah. I love that you have a recipe here that was very unexpected to me that deals with a potato. It was a sweet potato in your sweet potato section where you kind of bake it and then you slice it down the middle like as if you're about to load it up.
Mm-hmm.
Then you loaded it with miso butter and a fistful of arugula and some lemon zest shavings.
Oh, yeah. That's really good.
Whoa. That was really cool.
Okay, cool. Thank
you. Yeah. A lot of things here I thought were so dreamy looking and inventive, and they happened to be in the tofu chapter, which I'm not saying that because... like tofu needs help. They just really looked the most amazing. Like there's ginger scallion stuffed tofu here that looks just gorgeous and so savory.
Oh yeah.
Good idea there.
Thank you.
So you take like all these like little scallions and ginger, a little pinch of sugar and sesame oil, and it's pretty basic.
So anyone like has a thick, less saucy. Spoonable ginger scallion sauce.
Right, right.
And then you like make a little pocket of the... Though after I finished that recipe, I went to teach a class, and it's a little bit finicky, like writing it. So you're like making a little cut into the cubes of tofu and then spooning the sauce in the middle and then like putting it on top. And it looks really nice, but it's a little finicky. And I was teaching a cooking class up in Maine at Stonewall Kitchens, where I go a couple times a year. And the guy was like, I could not understand how this was. I was able to like fix the instructions. But he was like, I could not understand what you're talking about. So what I did is I just sandwiched the sauce between two little like slabs of tofu for this class.
To stuff it.
And I was like, why didn't I think about that? That would have been so much easier. I just had such a picture in my head of like the sauce like emerging volcano style from a little like block of tofu.
Right.
Anyway.
No, it's a great way to pack in the flavor there. And yeah, I mean, we're all familiar with something that's a little finicky that is stuffed, like a stuffed mushroom. It's not exactly the easiest thing to...
That's true.
To do, but yeah. And then you have the silken tofu with soy sauce tomatoes. Mm,
that's so good.
That looks so good.
And it's like the temperature contrast is such a delightful thing about that dish. You have these like warm stewed tomato. Like cherry tomatoes and cooked with a little bit of soy sauce. And then you have the cold silken tofu. And then so those two, you put the hot tomatoes over the cold tofu. And it's a very, very nice dish.
Oh my God, it's like a caprese, but with a sort of fluid, like juicy, jammy, warm cherry tomatoes.
Yes.
Yeah. And soy sauce.
A little bit more umami.
Right, from the soy sauce.
Yeah.
Sounds so refreshing. You write in the beginning for your tofu section that it's a bit of a controversial ingredient these days.
Yeah.
Perhaps unfairly. What's your take on that? Why is soy so disliked?
Well, I had been hearing anecdotally from a lot of people that, like, they're especially women were afraid to be eating too much soy for what it might do for estrogen stuff.
Right.
And then in doing a little bit of research, and I think a lot of people, your listeners probably know this already, but like this is more a symptom of like industrially produced products that include the soy, where just the protein is stripped from the soybean, so you have none of the fiber and all the other stuff that like makes the soybean so healthy and such a like a good form of plant-based protein. So that's where, so like
soy there lecithin, was this, that's
yeah,
an additive.
Yes, exactly, yeah. And just as a visual, the taking what for like a teaspoon of this like soy protein, the amount of soybeans that you would need in order to extract that much protein is really stark and alarming. So that's where that's just where to try from. To like correct that perception about tofu.
Yeah. Still do see that recommended, you know, just to be on the safe side, don't eat soy. But actually what's in a lot of processed food products and pretty much everything, they have soybean oil, which is industrial produced. So it's like, actually, you're eating it.
I know. But,
yeah, anyway, so tofu, we like it.
Yes.
I like that you I like that you include a quote from nutritionist and author Marion Nestle. You write that she advises that we regard tofu not as a miracle food, as it's often framed in the context of vegan and vegetarian diets, but as a food, one to incorporate into your diet with an eye toward balance. I feel this way about most ingredients.
Yeah, totally. What is, God, it's like right now as we're talking, we were just talking about the coronavirus and like this whole media shitstorm of messaging, and no one really like knows what's going on, and there's no leadership around it. And like, it's the same thing in food when all these like things pop up and get featured on Dr. Oz or whatever. It's like creates this hysteria around stuff.
Yep.
Really don't think it needs to be that
complicated. Right. Especially for food that people have been eating for centuries.
Exactly.
Bazillion years. So I am curious about the meat analogs that are coming out today based on hemoglobins and, you know, the fake meat that is like bleeding burgers from Impossible Beyond Burger and that kind of thing. That's a new thing.
Yeah. That's really like not for me.
I've
a couple of people have been asking me about this lately, and I used to have a veggie burger business that was like
made these by packs Lucas.
Of veg, it was so local good. Sort of to New York State vegetables packed into a little container and made into this like scoopable veggie burger mix where you could shape them into patties and cook them off. And the whole idea was that there was like a kale flavor, a beet flavor, and a carrot parsnip flavor.
Yeah.
And that it reinforced my strong belief that a veggie burger should taste like vegetables. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I really, like, I do understand where Impossible Burger and Beyond Burger fits into our, like, food system. Like, as a replacement for beef patties and fast food. People, like, can't tell the difference.
People don't care,
that seems like a
yeah.
pretty good advance, you know. But it's, like, too, you know, there's, like, this is where the veggie burger roads diverge.
Got it. Yeah. You know? It's like apples and oranges.
Yeah,
sounds
exactly.
Like. Okay, cool. Almost out of time, but I did want to ask something since, you know, this is not your first rodeo. This is your fourth cookbook now, and it's been 10 years since you've been publishing.
We were just talking. I came on your show 10 years ago.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It really is.
And actually, you've worked with three different publishers amongst these four books. What's changed in the landscape of food writing and cookbooks and food media is what I meant to say, in your opinion?
Well, I think that in the world of book publishing, cookbooks have been seen as like a bit of a bright spot. So there's been some doubling down, I think, in investment into cookbooks. And like when my first three books were all paperback books because there was just like a perception of what people would be willing to spend and I don't know, their business model for these types of things. And I think that since then, in the past like 10 years, there's an expectation has really developed around like creating a beautiful cookbook. And the in digital photography has like made it possible to have a photo for every recipe, though I've never been able to do that because I'm not a photographer.
I do see those comments sometimes that people were like, you didn't have a photo for every recipe.
I know, but people I hear that all the time. People want, they don't buy cookbooks unless there's a photo for every recipe.
Or they don't make that recipe.
It's kind of crazy, yeah. But I think that's changed it a lot. What was I? I was going to say something else. But and then in terms of like, I started out with a veggie burger cookbook, and like this publisher, The Experiment, has been kind of amazing because they were at the forefront of this. Like they,
that's cool.
There's
Harper
a lot
Wave.
Of like, well, not Harper Wave, but The Experiment was my first book publisher, and they focused on vegan and vegetarian stuff. And Matthew Mortlore, the publisher, had been doing this at his previous job, and the world of vegan cookbooks was really confined to these like outsider, like indie publishers, and they were selling tons and tons of copies of the successful ones. But I think mainstream publishers only recently started to take note of this traction and have been building it out and creating more of a market for these vegetable-oriented cookbooks.
Totally. Yeah. Well, that may be a reflection of changing tastes and consumers.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Meatless.
People opening themselves up to the idea.
And with books like yours, I don't see why not.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for this contribution. And I feel like we could spend hours talking, but thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Oh, thank you, Kathy. It's always I can actually say this, always a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure to have you on, too. So definitely check out Start Simple, and lucasvolger.com is, and Lucas Volger on Instagram and wherever you need to find him. And thanks, Jeet, and everyone at Heritage Radio Network. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words. Eat Your Words is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, there.
I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat & 3.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.